Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Welcome to yet another exciting show. Now, I've long suspected, as I wrote in a column not long ago, that American adolescence, for all practical purposes, now ends at 30. And more, if you look around at all the gray-haired people eating Doritos and playing video games, maybe it doesn't end at all. But in terms of actual kids, my guest tonight, psychology professor Dr. Lauren Steinberg, explains that there's a strong case to be made for delayed adulthood. On tonight's show, he'll explain why, along with taking us through what the latest research says about how to raise psychologically strong kids who are motivated to thrive. Read more in his book we'll be discussing, Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence, which you can find linked in the show text. And do stick with us for an illuminating hour. Hello, Larry.
Hi, how are you, Amy?
Hi, I'm so glad to have you on. Your book really breaks some ground. And you talk about how one of the most notable demographic trends in the last two decades has been the delayed entry of young people into adulthood. Tell us about that.
Well, if you look at current generation of people in their mid-20s and you compare them to previous generations, what you see is that it's taking people longer to move into what we ordinarily consider the conventional roles of adulthood. So they're getting married at a later age, they're having children at a later age, they're staying in school longer, and they're staying economically dependent on their parents longer. And the differences between today's people, let's say around 25, and their parents when they were 25 are very substantial. So there has been a very big shift toward a longer adolescence and a delayed adulthood.
And so what's society's view of this delay?
Well, I think that what's written about it has mainly been negative, and I think erroneously so. I think that millennials have been getting a very bad rap on this because I think that the way that it's often discussed in the popular media is that young people today are lazy, they're taking their time moving into adulthood because they're able to, that this is due to their parents having raised them in a way that's made them entitled and narcissistic. And as I explain in the book, we've looked at this, looking at very good data that goes back to the late 1970s, and we don't find that today's young people are any more narcissistic or self-absorbed than people were in previous generations. So I think that the most plausible explanation for the delayed transition into adulthood is that the changed economy and the changed labor force have just made it a rational thing to stay in school longer. And if you stay in school longer, I think it stands to reason that you're going to be dependent on your parents economically longer, and you're going to delay getting married. And if you delay getting married, you're going to delay having kids. So I think that the delayed adulthood is a rational response to the conditions that we live in today.
Now, you think that we need to reassess how we are raising our young people, and this has to do with how the brain continues to mature into the mid-20s.
Right, because one of the most exciting discoveries that neuroscientists have made in the last few years, really, in studying adolescent brain development, is that the brain is remarkably plastic during adolescence. So we've known for a long time now that the brain is very plastic or malleable during the early years, the years from 0 to 3. More recently, research has shown that there's a second period of heightened malleability, of heightened plasticity, and that period seems to be adolescence. One of the points that I make in the book is that perhaps by delaying the transition into adulthood, individuals may be keeping their brain plastic for a longer period of time.
Now, explain to us what that means, brain plasticity, because not everyone has heard that term.
Right. So the brain is able to change in response to experience. If you think about learning, for example, Whenever we learn something, there has to be some underlying change in the brain's neurobiology, or else there'd be no way of retaining that knowledge or that information. So the brain is always capable of changing in response to experience, and that capability is what neuroscientists refer to as plasticity or malleability. But what we also know is that the brain is plastic to different degrees at different points in development. And the two most plastic periods are very early in life and adolescence.
And that was what you're talking about with the 0 to 3. Those are the two times we don't really think of ourselves as having the second period of development in adolescence. And that's really one of the things that's so revolutionary about your work and your thinking on this, because it really shows incredible promise that we now aren't taking advantage of.
Well, I think that, as I say, plasticity cuts both ways. So it does make adolescence a time of promise and a time of opportunity if we're able to take advantage of that plasticity, but it also makes adolescence a time of vulnerability as well. So when the brain is malleable, when it's affected by experience, it's affected by good experiences and it's also affected by bad experiences. So not only do we need to make sure we take advantage of the opportunity that adolescent brain plasticity provides, but we also need to protect kids from experiences that are going to be harmful to the brain during a period of time in which the brain is so responsive to the environment.
Now, this is something you bring up at the beginning of the book. You say, when you're talking about the state of adolescence in America, you say they aren't doing well because you say, despite all this talk about overprotecting kids, that we're neither adequately protecting them from harm or taking advantage of the opportunity to promote this positive development at this time.
Yeah, I think if you look at the statistics on how kids in the United States are faring compared to kids in other developed countries, it's not a very promising picture. So I think most listeners will be familiar with the fact that in achievement comparisons that our high school students tend to do worse than kids from other developed countries, and countries even where they spend a lot less on education than we do. But in addition to that, on various indicators of problematic functioning, mental health, physical health, our kids don't do very well at all. We lead the world in childhood obesity and adolescent obesity. We lead the world in STDs and unintended pregnancies. We lead the world in youth violence and crime. So it's not simply that our adolescents are not doing as well in school as we would hope. They're also not doing as well on other metrics, too.
Now, I want to get back a little bit to plasticity because this is so fascinating. And you talk about two types of plasticity in your book. You say that there's developmental plasticity and adult plasticity. So can you tell us what those are, what the difference is?
Yeah. So as I said before, the brain is always somewhat plastic. So even in adulthood, the brain can change in response to experience. If that weren't the case, we wouldn't be able to learn anything as adults. And since learning does take place in adulthood, we know there must be some brain plasticity. But the type of plasticity and the extent of plasticity is very different after adolescence than it is during adolescence or before. So during childhood and adolescence, the brain is still being built. There are still new brain circuits that are developing, and some existing brain circuits are being eliminated because they're not needed, and that helps to make the brain more efficient. So a lot of the plasticity that occurs during adolescence and before has to do with the development of the brain itself. That's why we call it developmental plasticity. After adolescence, the brain changes in response to experience, but only in very minor ways. We don't develop really new brain circuits in adulthood. The process of eliminating unnecessary circuits, something that we call synaptic pruning, stops sometime during late adolescence. So even though it's technically correct that the brain is still plastic during adulthood, it's like the difference between remodeling your house and redecorating your house. Right? So during childhood and adolescence, we're still remodeling, putting on new rooms, taking steps to change the floor plan or the wiring or the plumbing. During adulthood, yeah, we're changing the curtains and the carpeting, but we're not really making any major changes to the basic structure or anatomy of the brain.
I liked another example you gave between to compare the childhood versus adult plasticity. You said you described the difference as the difference between learning how to read, which is a life-altering change, and reading a new book, which is usually not.
Right. So when we learn how to read, I mean, you can imagine that all kinds of new major underlying changes in the brain are taking place that permit the skill to develop. But when we read the morning paper or a new book, if we remember anything that we've read, yes, there has to have been some change in the brain. But it's not of the scope, it's not of the substance that learning how to read is. And that's the difference between developmental plasticity and adult plasticity.
And so this is starting to really reveal right now why it's so important to take advantage of this in adolescence, which you talk about in the rest of your book. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Lauren Steinberg, and his book we're discussing is Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. So I'd like you to tell us a little bit about why the brain is so plastic in adolescence, which takes explaining a bit about how the brain works.
Yeah. So the plasticity of the brain is seen in the development and elimination of synapses. So synapses are connections between neurons. So it's important to think about the brain really as an electric organ. So when information it travels through the brain, it travels in the form of electrical impulses that travel from one neuron to another. And we have circuits that regulate language and different brain circuits that regulate vision and brain circuits that regulate emotion and so forth. And whenever you experience anything through any sense, there is electricity, electrical impulses that are flowing through these brain circuits. But the neurons that comprise the circuits are not physically connected to each other. There's a tiny little space between them that's called a synapse. So the electrical impulse has to jump across this little space in order to travel down the circuit. Brain plasticity really involves the creation of new synapses, which allow new circuits to be formed, which allow us to do different things. And it also involves the elimination of synapses that we don't need anymore. And that's the process I mentioned earlier called synaptic pruning. And in fact, a lot of what takes place in brain development involves the elimination of unnecessary synapses rather than the production of new ones. So we're born with many, many more connections between our neurons and our brain than we really need. And the process of development really has to do with getting rid of the ones that are inefficient. It's like pruning your garden, which makes flowers grow better than if you didn't do any pruning at all. What we know now is that the chemicals that enter the brain as a result of puberty, as a result of sex hormones, actually change the process through which synapses develop and through which synapses are eliminated. So one of the reasons that there is this spurt in brain plasticity in adolescence is the impact of puberty on the brain.
And tell us about metaplasticity.
Well, it turns out that plasticity, which is the brain's capacity to be changed in response to the environment, is itself a malleable trait. It's itself a plastic trait. And there are some experiences that not only change the brain, but that actually make the brain more or less plastic. And this process of making the brain more or less plastic is what's referred to as metaplasticity. It's the plasticity of plasticity. and what we know is, for example, that learning helps to prime the brain to learn more in the future. So the more experiences we have during times when the brain is plastic that help facilitate brain development, the more likely we are to be able to take advantage of the environment in the future. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important to not squander the opportunity that adolescence provides. Because experiences during adolescence not only change the brain then, they also prime the brain to be able to be changed in the future.
Yeah, it's such fascinating stuff. I want to talk a little bit about how adolescents think, when we're talking about their brains. Draw us a picture of adolescent behavior and risk-taking. And you gave the example of 17-year-old Danny who got in a car crash.
Yeah, so one of the things that we've been doing a lot of research on this in our lab at Temple University for many years now, one of the things that is a hallmark of adolescence is that almost all forms of risky and reckless behavior are higher or more common during adolescence than they are during childhood or adulthood. So if you were to graph them out as a function of people's age, it would look like an upside-down U. So risk-taking increases from childhood into adolescence. It peaks in the late adolescent years, and then it declines as we develop into adulthood. And one of the things that's remarkable about this is that you see the same pattern across behaviors that on the surface don't seem to have anything to do with each other. So you see it for crime, and you see it for self-inflicted injury, and you see it for binge drinking, and you even see it for accidental drownings, which is very surprising since people are pretty strong during adolescence. And the fact that drownings are more common during adolescence than before or after probably reflects risky and reckless decision-making. One of the things that I've been studying since the mid-1990s is why it is that you see this big increase in risk-taking during adolescence and whether we can understand this by looking at the adolescent brain. So in short, you have brain systems that are changing during adolescence that impel us toward exciting and novel experiences. The system of the brain that responds to rewards is much more easily aroused during adolescence than before or after. But this arousal of this brain system takes place before self-regulation is mature. So the metaphor that we use to describe this is that it's like having the accelerator pressed to the floor before there's a good braking system in place. And so this kind of discrepancy between an easily aroused reward-seeking brain system and a still-developing self-regulation or braking system, the gap between those two is what we think makes adolescence a time of so much risky and reckless behavior.
And actually, you point out that there is an increase in this behavior, this risky behavior around puberty, and this occurs around the same age as its potential payoff, successful reproduction. And this, vis-a-vis what I know from various studies about men taking risks around women, for example, this makes a lot of sense, especially in males, that this would be a time that they would be taking risks because it's a way that they can show off to the girls.
Well, there is that for sure, but there's something else going on as well. Which is that, all mammals go through puberty. So we can learn a lot about human adolescence by looking at what happens in other species during this time period. And if you look at other mammals, what you see is that when the juvenile animals, the children, if you will, go through puberty, they typically start looking for mates. And in order to protect against inbreeding, they look for mates outside the family. In some species, they may actually leave their family and go exploring in the wild. And they enter into a situation in which they're competing with other animals for mates. And remember that they're still developing. They're still small. And they're still weak relative to adults. So it is a very risky proposition to go off on your own without the protection of older adult animals that have raised you, and really challenge other strangers for access to mates. So what we think is that adolescence evolved as a time when people are more willing to take risks, because if we weren't willing to take risks during this time period, we wouldn't really reproduce. So I don't think it's a coincidence that the peak in adolescent risk-taking coincides with a peak in adolescent fertility, because it is about reproducing that's driving the risky and reckless behavior.
And you say that although puberty is not something that just ignites our libido, that sex hormones make us more sensitive to rewards in general. So that makes sense with what you're saying about this reward-seeking behavior at this time.
Right. So a lot of the brain's response to rewards is due to activity involving the neurotransmitter dopamine. Dopamine serves many functions in the brain, but one of the most important is our experience of pleasure, our experience of reward. So we joke and say that when you're about to receive a reward or when you receive something that's rewarding, whether it's sex or food or praise from other people, that you get a little dopamine squirt. And what we know is that one of the effects of puberty on the brain is to increase activity in brain circuits that involve the neurotransmitter dopamine. So it really is the case that shortly after puberty and into middle and even late adolescence, good things feel even better than they feel during childhood or during adulthood. And this is, I think, something that most of us can recall. If you think about the first time you kissed somebody, that how intense that feeling was compared to the feelings that same behavior might have produced when you were a child or produces when you're an adult. So this makes adolescents super sensitive to rewards. And, of course, I think naturally this makes them much more interested in seeking out rewards because things feel so good.
Yeah, I think that's so important for people to understand, for parents especially to understand. And you say they're actually less sensitive to losses than adults.
Yeah, and I think one of the takeaways for parents and for other people that work with teenagers is that changing an adolescent's behavior by rewarding good behavior is going to be more effective than changing an adolescent's behavior by punishing bad behavior. So we know that adolescents are relatively more reward responsive and relatively less punishment responsive than people are at other ages.
Yeah, that's really important to remember. And you actually come up with some interesting differences in your research with your colleagues on why adolescents take more risks than adults. And there are two important differences, you say, that people's sensitivity to potential rewards from a risky choice peaks at age 16. That's the first one or so. So it's easier to get adolescents to gamble, for example.
That's right. And we do experiments where we have people in the MRI scanner where we're doing brain imaging while we have them engaging in different kinds of tasks that on a computer screen that they can see while their brains are being imaged. And we and many other people have found that if you present individuals of different ages with rewarding stimuli, this can be pictures of smiling faces or pictures of coins or opportunities to gamble and win, that you see a much stronger response in the brain of an adolescent than you do in the brain of a child or the brain of an adult.
Yeah, and you talk about the impulsivity, the reward sensitivity combined with poor self-control, and say this isn't just the case here in the USA. We like to picture ourselves as having the worst of children, but we really don't.
Yeah, I mean, in a study that we're just finishing up now, we've been studying these developmental processes, these developmental patterns in 12 different countries, including some that are, you know, reasonably similar to the United States, like Sweden or Italy, and some that are very different, like Kenya or Jordan. And what we are seeing is very similar patterns of development, both in reward-seeking behavior, which seems to increase and peak during adolescence in the various countries that we've been studying this, and in impulse control, which improves gradually over the course of adolescence and into the first half of the 20s, and we see this improvement around the world as well.
I want to get into self-regulation, which you've been touching on throughout. But first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Lauren Steinberg, and his book we're discussing is Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence, and you can find a link to it in the show text. So self-regulation, this is so important. Tell us about it.
Well, self-regulation, which is the catch-all term that psychologists use to refer to our ability to control our thoughts and our emotions and our behaviors, self-regulation is probably the most important psychological trait a person can have in life. If you look at research on what predicts positive mental health, self-regulation is one of the strongest, most consistent predictors. People who score high in measures of self-regulation do better in school, they have better relationships, they're less likely to develop mental health problems, they're less likely to get into trouble. I mean, really, from the point of view of parenting, if there is one trait that you ought to try to instill in your child, it's good self-regulation. And in the book, I do talk about things that parents can do to help this. But one point to really drive this home is that studies that have looked at what predicts how well kids do in school find consistently that self-regulation is a stronger predictor than either intelligence or talent is. So it's a very, very important skill to help develop in your child.
Yeah, you tell some very interesting stories about this. And one of them is about your own predictions of academic achievement in students. And we all think, oh, smart, good, she'll be successful. But the story you tell is of a student named Lucy. Tell us about her and what she would do and what she would not do.
So Lucy, which is not the student's real name, Lucy entered into our doctoral program in our Department of Psychology and came to study with me. She was admitted on the basis of having terrific grades and outstanding GRE scores. This was a while ago before the scoring of the GRE had changed, but it was in the days when we looked at people's math scores and verbal scores, and each one, the maximum score was 800. So a perfect GRE would be 1600. And this young woman had scores that were, I think, around 1500, even a little bit higher than that. So she clearly was smart. She did very well in college. She interviewed very well, too. When she got to graduate school, she just didn't have the drive. She didn't have the ambition or the initiative to be successful. And it was frustrating for me as her advisor to find that, you know, we would make plans for the work that she was going to get done in the lab and for the papers that she was going to write. And things just didn't get done. And we would meet every couple of weeks, and I would say, have you made any progress on such and such an analysis? And she would say, no, I just, I haven't yet. And we'd make a plan for the next couple of weeks, and it was the same thing over and over and over again. So my experience as somebody who's been advising doctoral students for, almost 40 years now, is that it's not high test scores that predict who does well in graduate school. It's this drive and this ambition. We don't have good ways of measuring that. We don't have good tests that tell us beforehand who is going to have this drive and who isn't. But I've talked to lots of people in different fields about this, and everybody agrees that once people have reached a certain level of intellectual ability, the difference between the successful ones and the less successful ones is really all in their perseverance and their determination and in what some psychologists call grit.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, grit is really the ability to persist and to persevere toward achieving a goal, even in the face of obstacles that might make it difficult. And I think we can all look at people that we know from where we've worked or where we've gone to school, and that some people are just grittier than other people. And grit is a very strong predictor of success in life. So one of the things I argue in the book is that we don't spend enough time helping kids develop grit. We don't spend enough time in school on activities that help do this, and I don't think spend enough time at home in the way we raise kids. We are very focused in this country on intelligence as the determinant of success. And intelligence is important, but that's not the whole story.
Yeah, I think you're really right about this and right about how we don't train kids in this or say it's important. We don't really even talk about it, about perseverance and talking about how this is such a great quality. I mean, maybe your grandpa does at some point, but not in the way that's commensurate with how important it is to kids' success.
Well, one of the things that one of the big mistakes that we make, and I think we make this in school and we make it at home as well, is we're so nervous about our kids failing that we tend to make things easy. Our schools, and I spend a fair amount of time in the book talking about this, our high schools are among the easiest in the world. And we know this because studies have been done that have queried kids who have been from other countries who spent part of their high school careers in the United States. And we've also done studies, experts have done studies in which we've looked at American kids who've spent some of their high school years abroad. And the picture is very consistent, regardless of whether you're asking foreign students who've studied in the U.S. or U.S. students who've studied abroad. And the picture is that American schools are very easy. And when we don't challenge kids, they're not given opportunities to develop things like perseverance and determination, because they can accomplish what they need to accomplish without exerting a great deal of effort.
There's also such an emphasis on grades over learning, and what you're talking about, schools being easy. I took zero AP classes in high school because I could do that and still get into University of Michigan, and because I was doing all this reading on my own, and I didn't want the things that school made me learn to get in the way of my reading. And so, I mean, I was still doing something, but I just knew that I had to get A's to get into Michigan, and there was no emphasis on learning other than the fact that I was doing some learning on my own, just not, you know, the assignments.
Well, it's changed a little bit now, in that I think that a lot of colleges have recognized that a better predictor of success in undergraduate education is the extent to which the high school student has put herself in situations in which she's being challenged, rather than just simply looking, you know, at how high her grades are. So I think the recommendation that most admissions officers would give kids now is to take the hardest classes you can take, and that's more important than getting a straight A average.
Yeah, I have a friend who's pretty young, and she was applying to college, and she had gotten, I think, like a D or something in some terribly hard science class. And I told her to write to the administrators or write to the people, the admissions people, and say, look, you know, this class, I knew it was over my head, but I wanted to take it and, you know, have this challenge and everything, because I think that people do appreciate that more than people like me who just, I mean, I skipped my entire year of senior year of high school. I had an internship at a TV station. I was supposed to go on Tuesday and Thursday. And I just thought, like, oh, I don't have to show up, because I could write papers to get out. And I just think that it really, it's pretty terrible that it's that easy that you can just not show up for a year.
Right. Well, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what surveys of American high school students indicate is that is that school is so easy that they don't have to work very hard to get good grades. And, you know, let's remember, we are talking about people that are still young and that are still not, you know, maybe capable of making all these important decisions on their own. And if we as adults don't help guide them toward experiences that are going to be facilitative of positive development, we can't expect them to do this on their own. So, you know, it's not correct, I think, to look at American adolescents and say, oh, this, you know, we have a bunch of lazy kids. I think it's better to look at our education system and say, we are not doing what we need to be doing to help stimulate positive intellectual development and to help build things like grit and perseverance.
I think this self-regulation is so important. I want to dig a little bit back into that. And a big emphasis, there's a now versus later in self-regulation. And you, in fact, have a test that you titled that. And tell us what it is, what it measures, and how it works.
Well, in the version of the test that we use, and we are studying you know, people who are at least 10 years old, so we're not studying little kids. We give people choices between two alternative rewards, hypothetical rewards. Would you rather have you know, $200 now, or would you rather have $800 a year from now? And we ask them these kinds of questions over and over again, and in the end, we can calculate how much an individual prefers an immediate reward as opposed to a delayed reward that's going to be larger.
And well, there's prefers, and there's, you know, can take. So do you differentiate, you know, can deal with or prefers?
We study preferred. So this is not some of your listeners may be familiar with the marshmallow test, in which kids are asked to see if they can withhold an impulse to grab a marshmallow. Ours is not like that. Ours is a measure of preference.
You talk about getting to the indifference point, and that's the point at which the immediate and delayed offers feel equivalent. So you offer them, okay, you'll take the $800, well, you know, and you ask them, you counteroffer something like a little bit bigger that comes sooner. And so what's the point of that?
Well, that people with different indifference points behave differently in the real world. So individuals who have a low indifference point are willing to settle for less in order to get it sooner, whereas people who have a higher indifference point are willing to wait in order to get something bigger later. And people that that have higher indifference points, turns out, in general are more successful in life and less likely to get into trouble. So if you look at extreme groups of people who have difficulty controlling themselves, people like addicts, for example, that they tend to have lower indifference points in these kinds of studies because they're much more strongly oriented toward getting a reward immediately, even if it's a smaller one than they would get if they waited.
Now, you tell this story in your book, very compelling story of Angelica, who's this economically disadvantaged girl. She went to maybe Emory, and she could get a full ride in scholarship, but she kept making all these bad decisions. So she was eligible for this full ride, but she didn't even fill out her forms for financial aid on time, despite getting many reminders from the university. So what do you think went wrong here?
Well, this is a story that was reported in the New York Times, and it was a story that looked at three young women from Texas who were from disadvantaged communities, poor families, but who were able to go to a college prep after school program that was to help get them ready for going to college. And these young women did well on standardized tests, and they went through this college prep course. And Angelica, was accepted to Emory University, which is one of the top universities in the United States, and which has a very generous financial aid policy. So they not only accepted her, but they offered her a free ride, tuition and living expenses. But there were a few things that she had to do in order to get this, which was to complete some forms on time. And she had difficulty getting it together to do those things. And as a result of that, she needed to find ways of earning money when she was in school. She made a lot of bad decisions about how to spend her time, about a relationship with a boyfriend that was not a very good relationship and not good for her, and she ended up falling behind in school.
Now, what do you think went wrong here?
Well, I think that that she was somebody that had not been raised in a way that led her to be able to delay rewards, and I think that she focused on kind of the immediate and not on the long-term plan. And to get through college, you really need to be able to focus on the longer term rather than the immediate. And she ended up dropping out of school and never getting her degree.
Now, you find this self-regulation, which is the heart of determination, to be highly determined by genes. So, you know, maybe that's part of what's going on here. And also, I look at this through the prism also of life history theory, which says that if you grow up in an unstable environment, like poor kids tend to, where maybe there's gang warfare or terrible things going on and people die and people don't take very good care of their children sometimes because maybe they have to work as a single person and their kids are home alone, that in this unstable environment, it pays to have a nap, not later attitude. So a short-term orientation. And then in a stable environment, it pays to wait. What's your... Do you think that this maybe played a part in this, or do you think that there's something else?
Well, I think that things like self-regulation are multiply determined. So there are clearly genetic influences, but there are environmental influences. Some of them, I agree, are due to the influence of the early environment to which kids are exposed. And I've actually written some papers on the very thing that you're talking about, which is how early experience in unstable and unpredictable environments can lead people to develop a more short-term orientation. But I think we should also say that studies show that there are things that parents can do to help build stronger self-regulation in their kids and to help build a less intense, immediate orientation toward the environment. And there's a type of parenting that I describe in the book that psychologists call authoritative parenting, which is parenting that combines warmth and firmness, and that this has been shown to facilitate better self-regulation, stronger mastery motivation, more grit than other kinds of parenting.
Let's get it. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Let's get into that. So these authoritative parents, you talk about warmth, firmness, and being supportive. So let's take those one by one. So these are the things that foster grit and determination. And so being warm, I love you say you can't love your kid too much and you should be physically affectionate and these are things that I think that some people think, oh, you want to create a tough kid, but the toughness doesn't come from being cold and withholding.
No, it doesn't. And actually, the study of parenting and its effect on kids' development is one of the oldest in all of child psychology. So this has been studied for at least 75 years. The findings of research on this are actually amazingly consistent across studies. So we know what works if you want to develop certain skills or capabilities in kids. And one of the things that this research has disproven is the school of hard knocks, you know, approach to raising kids. Character is built much more by being warm and involved and affectionate with your kids than it is by being aloof and withholding and cold. So it really is, you know, of the three things that parents can do, one of the most important is to be warm and affectionate with your children, even as they move from childhood into adolescence.
We've talked about this a lot on the show. It's attachment research by a British psychologist or psychiatrist John Bowlby and carried on by Murray Ainsworth and others. And there's some really interesting newer research that talks about what you're saying, the dependency paradox by Brooke C. Feeney, where she talks about their finding was that the more a person felt that they could rely on their partner for love and comforting when they needed it, the more independent they could be. So it really does show exactly what you're saying, that it's the opposite of this hard knocks school of parenting, which actually doesn't work out so well for kids.
Right. So security, which is fostered by a close attachment relationship, just as an aside, through pure coincidence, my first psychology professor was Mary Ainsworth.
Wow. Cool.
When I was a freshman starting out, I didn't even know who she was. She was important. When kids are raised in a secure environment and form a strong attachment to their caregivers, they develop confidence. And they have confidence because they have faith that the environment is going to treat them well. Warmth is one thing that we know that helps foster a secure attachment to parents. But it's not enough to be warm. So the second component of effective parenting is being firm. And by being firm, I mean having expectations, having rules, enforcing them, having consequences when the child violates the rules. And kids need structure and routine. I think a big mistake that parents often make is that they confuse what something would feel like to them with what it feels like to a child. So too much structure and too much routine to us as adults feels boring and stultifying, and we feel constrained by it. But to a child, especially a young child, it makes the world feel predictable, and it makes the world feel like a more secure place. And so by being firm and being consistent in the way that you discipline your child, you're helping to further build this sense of competence as well as confidence.
Yeah, I see. The more I read research just across the spectrum, behavioral science, evolutionary psychology, I see how important, how essential stability is to kids. I think that that's really, really important. And also, you bring up something else in the section you write on how being firm is important for raising kids who are good at self-control. And that's being fair. And that's something I know as a kid, I felt that really intensely. I still do now. I feel unfairness very acutely, but I think that kids, especially because they're kind of powerless, they can't just say, I'm going to get in the car and drive off to the liquor store, that fairness thing is essential to them.
Well, I think that what parents may not realize is that when they discipline their children in a way that kids perceive as fair, their kids are much more likely to comply. And this is especially true during adolescence when kids have the intellectual abilities, to abstract and to make judgments about what's fair and what's not fair. So it's one of the reasons why psychologists like myself emphasize the importance of explaining to your child why you have certain rules and expectations, because that helps your child understand that the rule that you've made is not arbitrary, but something that you have created or imposed in order for the child's best interests.
Yeah, I think that is so important. Now, the third thing you bring up is being supportive. But first, this is Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Lauren Steinberg, and his book we're discussing is Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. I highly recommend it, and you can find a link to it within the show text. So being supportive also, as a parent, also helps a child develop self-control. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I talk about being supportive, especially of the child's developing needs for independence and autonomy. And I describe a process that psychologists call scaffolding, which is where you put your child in situations that are just a little bit more challenging than what he's proven himself to be capable of in the past, so that he can succeed and improve. And by being supportive of this, you'll help facilitate the development of this sense of competence and confidence. So if you're always giving your child things to do that are too easy, that are not challenging, that's not good. But if you overwhelm your child with expectations that exceed what he's capable of, that's not good either. So good parents can find that sweet spot where they're able to support their child's growing sense of independence and growing sense of competence.
You have this great line there in the talking about that, protect when you must, but permit when you can. And I know that's hard for parents because, I mean, if I ever babysit for my neighbor's kids, I'm terrified they're going to all kill themselves. And I'll have to call their parents and say your kid has a smashed head from standing on the back of the couch. But that's really a part of parenting, contrary to all this helicopter parenting, where that's more comfortable for parents. And I think that they need to be a little more concerned about what's good for their kids.
Yeah, kids learn by being put in situations that are going to be challenging to them. And, we have to, as parents, sometimes step back and say that my child may not succeed at this. But your role really as a parent is to give your child the opportunity to succeed, or the opportunity even to fail, because there's a lot of learning that takes place when a child fails. So I think the challenge for parents is to look at a situation and say, really, what can go wrong here? And is what can possibly go wrong something that's going to harm my child in a way that's not going to be easily repaired? So you don't want to let your child be in situations that are going to be potentially damaging to her health or her future. But you do want to let her be in situations where she gets to make some of her own decisions, even if she's going to make some decisions that are bad.
Now, I want to talk about protecting adolescents from themselves. And you talk about how crime rises during adolescence and then falls during a person's 20s. So talk a little bit about why.
Well, we talked before about the fact that you have this situation where you have an accelerator that's pressed down to the floor and a braking system that's not yet mature. And we know that poor self-control is a very robust predictor of involvement in criminal activity. But one of the other things that we've been studying in our research is how being in groups affects this dynamic. And we have shown in a series of studies that adolescents make riskier and more reckless decisions when they're in groups than when they're by themselves. And this is not the case for adults. What's interesting about this research is that we've done studies now where we've done brain imaging and where we have shown that when adolescents are simply in the presence of their peers, this lights up these reward centers of the brain, which further increases kids' sensation-seeking and novelty-seeking. So to the extent that there is already an imbalance between that brain system and the brain's braking system, that imbalance is even accentuated when kids are in groups. So parents need to understand that an adolescent who has demonstrated very responsible self-control when he's been on his own may be a different person when he's with his friends. And what we've shown in our research is this is not simply because friends explicitly encourage each other to take risks. It's because of the impact of being in a peer group on the way the adolescent brain works.
And actually, you talk about this, the peer effect. You did a study of risky driving, and it seems there's a bit of practical advice there, which is that the rule parents should have for their kids in driving is you never get to drive with a friend in the car.
Well, at least not until you're confident that your child's driving skills are not simply, you know, at the level of a beginner. Now, some states, like Pennsylvania, where I live, have, you know, state regulations that prohibit adolescent drivers from driving with friends in the car when they first get their licenses. And, you know, if you're a parent and you live in a state that doesn't have that kind of law, there's no reason why you can't have that as a rule in your family. It turns out that, you know, driving with teen passengers in the car for a new adolescent driver is as risky as driving after drinking. And, you know, I think a lot of parents would not let their kids drive after they've been drinking, but they don't have any hesitation about letting their kids get in a car and drive with three other teenagers in it. And it's just as dangerous to do.
Right. And you talk about in some of the advice you give, you say, be aware of the emotional and social circumstances that can undermine your child's judgment. And this is one of them. You say, you know, also that when they're stressed or fatigued, you know, that they don't display the same good judgment and self-regulation that they might under optimal conditions. And people don't really realize this, that self-regulation, you might be a high scorer in it on, you know, when you're not in these stressful or peer situations, when you're not tired. So they need to look out for that too.
Yeah. You know, I think that because self-regulation is still developing during adolescence, it has a kind of now you see it, now you don't quality to it. And parents should be aware that under certain conditions, under ideal conditions, adolescents may demonstrate very mature judgment and very mature decision-making, but that this maturity may be upset and interfered with when kids are in situations that are emotionally arousing, or when they're fatigued, or when they're under stress. So one of the things I try to do in the book is to explain the situations under which adolescents' judgment is just as good as adults, but the situations under which it's undermined, because self-regulation during adolescence is still kind of tenuous.
I'm remembering, I hope correctly, that that when they're not stressed out, that a 16-year-old might have an adult's sort of sense on some things. And then I think it was 15 and 16-year-olds, but then the stress comes in and then forget it.
Yeah. And you know, again, it's important for parents to not necessarily think that the kind of judgment that their teenager has demonstrated under ideal circumstances is necessarily going to be displayed under more dicey circumstances.
Yeah, I think that that's very, very important. Now, one thing that that we don't really think about is how important it is to have kids mature later physically, to have later puberty. So why is early puberty a problem?
Well, early puberty is a problem for a number of reasons. One is that, remember that this arousal of the reward-seeking system that we've talked about is driven by the sex hormones of puberty. So when somebody goes through puberty earlier, they're going to have that arousal of the reward system occur at an earlier age, where the braking system is even more immature. So that's one reason why it's not good. A second is that we often judge kids on the basis of how they look, and there isn't a one-to-one relationship between how physically mature an adolescent looks and how emotionally mature she is. So early maturing girls are often put into situations that aren't the best in terms of their psychological development. And there are a lot of studies that show that early maturing girls are pressured by boys who are older than they are to have sex or to engage in other kind of adult-like behaviors before the girls are emotionally or psychologically ready for it, just because of the way that they look. So there's a lot of research showing that early maturation is stressful for girls and is associated with higher rates of depression and behavior problems.
And you talk about some reasons for this, that saying it's more common early puberty, children born with a low birth weight, because it leads to overproduction of insulin, and eating too much sugar, or increases in family stress is another reason, and endocrine disruptors. And so one thing, I guess, would be parents feeding their kids a lot of soy. You know, these girls have boobs at 8. And so I think that parents really need to look at these things. You know, is there a divorce happening in your family? Do you really need to do that? Can't you, you know, go do your separate things and stay a family, so your kids have the stability? I mean, that's one of my opinions. If you're not throwing things at each other, can't you, you know, stay a happy family like that for your kids?
Well, I think probably the most important thing that parents can do to help minimize the chances of their child going through puberty early, you know, have to do with preventing obesity. I mean, obesity is probably the most significant contributor to early puberty among contemporary adolescents. And the second is probably exposure to these endocrine disrupting chemicals that are in certain kinds of cosmetics and plastics and certain kinds of foods. So those would be the two things I would recommend that parents focus on.
Now, we're almost out of time, but you have some great advice at the end of the book, and I want to tell people about your book. I am talking with Dr. Lawrence Steinberg, and his book we're discussing is Age of Opportunity: Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. And one of these is just great. It's, you say, don't worry about whether your 20-something child is taking too long to grow up. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I think that, you know, it's natural for us as parents to judge our kids' timetable, you know, in comparison to what ours was when we were that age. And as we were discussing earlier, things have changed. And the timetable for moving into adulthood is not the same now as it was earlier. So just because your child seems to be taking longer to settle into a career, or into a marital or quasi-marital relationship doesn't necessarily mean that your child is floundering. It's a different world out there now. And as I discuss in the book, delaying the transition into adulthood might not even be a bad thing at all.
Thank you so much. This has been such a wonderful and illuminating show. I've been talking with Dr. Lauren Steinberg. His book, The Age of Opportunity, Lessons from the New Science of Adolescence. Thank you again.
Thank you.